Through the efforts alone of my silver tongue and tin-quick mind, I gained access to Lady Lavant's private party in New Saren, wherein she planned to auction the only remaining buttons from the Lord Mistborn's favorite smoking jacket. Handruim, my faithful Terrasman steward, had prized the information that the leader of the Cobbles Guilders planned to steal the buttons by swapping them with impeccable forgeries at some point during the night. As Handruim watched the tin buttons from the hors d'oeuvres table, I rubbed elbows with Lady Lavant and her inner circle, who found me completely enchanting. That was when the man in the striped white suit pointed a gun at me. Continued below. Ellendale feels effects of Corbeau flooding. Higher commodities prices to impact market performance. As one of the basin's key grain-producing regions struggles to rebuild following the breaking of the dam near Corbeau, unanswered questions still threaten the comfort of those at the heart of the basin. The Argean Ore Financial Circle, Ellendale's largest and most prestigious committee of bankers and other financial leaders, has called an emergency meeting to discuss sending aid to the flood-ravaged area. The biggest question haunting the circle is if the investment of boxings and resources will be enough to affect the commodities markets, which are just now beginning to founder under the prediction of grain harvests half as large as last year's. There are enough supplies in reserve to meet most demands over the next 4 months, said Lord Chapmont Heviers, a circle member with strong ties to Corbeau. But after that, most grain will start going to the highest bidder. If you own bakeries, you will think twice about selling loaves at 5 clips each, when you could be selling whiskey at 40 clips a bottle. All children love Suni Pops. You can move its legs. Real fur. Your child's new best friend. Only 75 clips, or 1 boxing 50 for 2. Viff Sparkle Tonic cures fatigue. Doctors Franks and Sylvest Viff have the remedy for drowsiness and irritability caused by animalcules, ulcers, and poor nutrition. Remember what the doctors say. Drink Viff Sparkle Tonic every day. Pectin Aid. The basin's favorite snack. Try all 8 flavors. Only 10 clips a box. You'll be glad you stayed for Pectin Aid. Guest Editorial. The Nuisance of Negligent Coin Shots. In the last 16 months, I have replaced 3 lampposts, an iron gate, and 2 steeple spires, all at my Madison Ways house. My residence in the 6th octant, much nearer the hub, has needed twice that attention due to it being on Visitors from Other Worlds. The sinister soiree continued. I described my assailant as wearing a striped white suit, but that is not as specific as it may seem. In Ellendale, someone dressed as described would stick out like afternoon tea among Kolos. But in New Saren, the men... 6. Wax soared through the air above Ellendale, hat held by strings to his neck, mistcoat waving behind him like a banner. Below, the city bustled and moved, people swarming through its roadway arteries. Some glanced at him, but most ignored him. Allomancers were not the rarity here they had been in the roughs. All these people, Wax thought, pushing off a fountain shaped like mists condensing into harmony, with arms upraised, bracers glittering golden on the otherwise green copper statue. Women sat on its stone edge. Children played in its waters. Motor cars and horse carriages broke around it, sweeping to the sides and charging down other roads, going about the ever-important business of city life. So many people. And here, in the 4th octant, a frightening percentage of them were his responsibility. To begin with, he paid their wages, or oversaw those who did. On the solvency of his house rested the financial stability of thousands upon thousands. But that was only part of it, because through his seat in the Senate he represented any who worked for him, or who lived on properties he owned. 2 divisions within the Senate. One side, the representatives of the professions, was elected and came and went as people's needs changed. The other side, the seats of the noble houses, was stable and immutable, not subject to the whims of voters. The governor, elected by the seats, presided over them all. A good enough system, except it meant that Wax was supposed to look after tens of thousands of individuals he could never know. His eye twitched, and he turned, pushing off some rebar sloppily left sticking from a tenement wall. Towns were better in the roughs, where you could know everyone. That way you could care for them, and really feel you were doing something. Marcy would argue that statistically leading his house here was more effective in creating general human happiness, but he wasn't a man of numbers. He was a man who trusted his gut. His gut missed knowing the people he served. Wax landed on a large water tower near a glass dome covering his octant's largest church of the survivor. People were worshipping inside, though a greater number would come at dusk to await the mists. The church revered the mists, and yet with that glass dome they still separated themselves from it. Wax shook his head, then pushed off along the nearby canal. "He's probably finished by now," Wax thought. "He'll be on one of the nearby docks, listening to the lapping water." He continued along the canal, which was cluttered with boats. Twindall Promenade, which ran along this canal, was crowded, even more so than usual, dense with life. It was difficult not to feel subsumed by the great city, engulfed, overwhelmed, insignificant. Out in the roughs, Wax hadn't just enforced the law. He had interpreted it, revised it when needed. He had been the law. Here he had to dance around egos and secrets. As Wax searched for the right dock, he was surprised to eventually find the reason for the traffic on the promenade. It was all bunched up, trying to get through a large clot of men with signs. Wax passed overhead and was shocked to see a small cluster of constables from the local octant amid the picketers. They were being pressed on all sides by the shouting men, waving signs in an uncomfortably violent manner. Wax dropped through the air and pushed lightly on the nails in the promenade boards here, slowing his descent. He landed in a crouch in an opening nearby, mistcoat flaring, guns clinking. The picketers regarded him for a long moment, then broke apart, taking off in different directions. He didn't even have to say a word. In moments, the beleaguered constables emerged, like stones on the plain as the soil washed away in a sudden rain.
"Thanks, sir,"
said their captain, an older woman whose blonde hair poked down straight about an inch on all sides around her constable's hat. "They're getting violent?" Wax asked, watching the last of the picketers vanish. "Didn't like us trying to move them off the promenade, Dawnshot," the woman said. She shivered. "Didn't expect it to go so bad, so fast."
"Can't say I blame them much,"
one of the other constables said, a fellow with a neck like a long-barreled pistol. His fellows turned to him, and he hunched down.
"Look, you can't say you don't have mates among them. You can't say you haven't heard them grumble. Something needs to change in this city. That's all I'm saying."
"They don't have the right to block a main thoroughfare," Wax said, "no matter their grievances. Report back to your precinct and make sure you bring more men next time." They nodded, hiking off. The promenade's knot of pedestrians slowly unwound itself, and Wax shook his head, worried. The men running the strikes did have a grievance. He'd found some of the same problematic conditions among the few factories he owned. Long hours, dangerous environments, and had been forced to fire a few overseers because of it. He'd replaced them with overseers who instead would hire more men for shorter shifts, as there was no shortage of laborers in the city who were out of work these days. But then he'd needed to up wages so that the men could live on the shorter shift income, making his goods more costly. Difficult times. And he didn't have the answers. Not to those problems. He hiked along the promenade a short distance, drawing more than a few stares from people he passed. But he soon found what he was looking for. Wayne sat on a narrow dock nearby. He had his shoes and socks off, feet in the water, and was staring off down the canal.
"Hello, Wax," he said without looking as Wax stepped up.
"It went poorly?" Wax asked.
"Same as always. It's strange. Most days I don't mind being me. Today I do."
Wax crouched down, resting a hand on the younger man's shoulder.
"Do you ever wonder if you should have just shot me?" Wayne asked. "Back when you and John first found me?"
I'm not in the habit of shooting people who can't shoot back, Wax said.
I could have been faking.
No, you couldn't have been. Wayne had been a youth of 16 when Wax and John Deadfinger, a lawman who had been mentoring Wax, had found him curled up in the crawl space under a house, hands over his ears, cloaked in dirt and whimpers. Wayne had thrown his guns and ammunition down a well. Even as Deadfinger had dragged him out, Wayne had been complaining of the gunfire, shots only he could hear, echoing from that well.
Any number of the boys we run across and take down, Wayne said. Any of them could be like me. Why did I get a second chance? But none of them did.
Luck. Wayne turned to meet his eyes. I'd give those lads second chances if I could, Wax said. Maybe they've had their moments of doubt, regret. But the ones we shoot, we don't find unarmed, hiding, willing to be brought in. We find them killing. And if I'd found you in the process of armed robbery all those years ago, I'd have shot you, too.
You're not lying, are you?
Of course not. I'd have shot you right in the head, Wayne.
You're a good friend, Wayne said. Thanks, Wax.
You're the only person I know that I can cheer up by promising to kill him.
You didn't promise to kill me, Wayne said, pulling on his socks. You promised to have killed me. That there be the present perfect tense.
Your grasp of the language is startling, Wax said, considering how you frequently brutalize it.
Ain't nobody what knows the cow better than the butcher, Wax.
I suppose, Wax said, standing up.
Have you ever met a woman named Idashwi? A ferrochemist? Steel runner?
Wax nodded.
Never met her, Wayne said. They keep kicking me out of the village when I visit. Right on neighborly.
So far as Wax knew, that wasn't true. Wayne would occasionally toss on some terrace robes, mimic their accents, then sneak in to live among them for a few days. He'd eventually get into trouble for saying something crude to one of the young women, but he wouldn't get thrown out. He'd baffle them, as he did most people, until he got bored and wandered away.
Let's see what we can find, Wax said, waving down a canal gondola.
5 notes for 1 basket of apples? That's robbery!
Marcy hesitated on the street. She'd driven the motor car up to the hub for the governor's speech, then parked it with the coachman who took pay to watch and refuel motors, intending to walk the rest of the way on foot. The hub could be a busy place. That led her here, near this small street market with people selling fruit. With disbelief, she saw that one vendor was, indeed, selling apples at 5 notes a basket. Those shouldn't cost more than half a boxing per basket at most. She'd seen them for a handful of clips.
I could get these at Ellen's stand for a fraction of the price, the customer said.
Well, why don't you go see if he has any left, the cart owner said, nonplussed.
The customer stormed off, leaving the cart owner with her sign proudly proclaiming the ridiculous price. Marcy frowned, then glanced down the row of stands, barrels, and carts.
Suspiciously low quantities all round.
She walked up to the cart owner with the high prices. The woman stood stiffly, braids shaking, and shoved her hands into the pockets of her apron.
Officer, she said. 5 is on the high side, wouldn't you say?
Marcy asked, picking up an apple.
Unless these are infused with atium. Am I doing anything wrong? The woman asked.
You have the right to set your prices, Marcy said. One simply wonders what you seem to know that nobody else does.
The woman didn't respond.
Shipment coming late? Marcy asked. Apple harvest gone bad?
The woman sighed.
Not apples, officer. Green shipments out of the east. Simply not coming. Floods did them in.
A little early to be speculating on food prices, don't you think?
Pardon, officer, but do you know how much food this city eats? We're 1 shipment away from starvation, we are.
Marcy glanced down the row again. Food was moving quickly, most of it, from what she could see, being sold to the same group of people. Speculators grabbing up the fruits and sacks of grain. The city wasn't as close to starvation as the cart owner claimed.
There were storages that could be released, but bad news moved faster than calm winds. And there was a good chance this woman was right, that she'd be able to sell her apples at a premium until things calmed down in a few days. Marcy shook her head, setting down the apple, and continuing toward the hub. There was always a press here, people on the promenade, vehicles on the streets trying to force their way into the ring around the hub. More people today, crowds drawn by the speech causing traffic clots in the regular bustle. Marcy could barely make out the giant statues of the Ascendant Warrior and her husband in the Field of Rebirth, peeking out over the throng. Marcy walked up to join another group of constables who had just arrived on Aradel's orders, their carriages lagging behind her motor car. Together they wended their way through the streets on foot toward the executive mansion. The governor preferred to address people from its steps, a few streets up into the second octant from the hub. They soon reached the large square before the mansion. Moving here was more difficult, but fortunately the constables from this octant were already in attendance, and they had roped off various areas near the front and sides of the square. In one, dignitaries and noblemen sat on bleachers to hear the address. In another, the second octant constables clustered and watched the crowd for pickpockets from the steps up into the National Archives. Other constables moved through the crowd, officers readily identifiable by the blue plumes on their hats. Marcy and Lieutenant Javies, who had commanded the field team, made their way toward the National Archives, where their colleagues from the second octant let them pass. A mustachioed older constable was directing things here, his helm under his arm, bearing the double plume of a captain. When he saw Marcy, Javies, and the team, the man lit up.
"Ah, so Aradel sent me reinforcements after all," he exclaimed. "Rusting wonderful. You chaps go watch the east side of the square, down Longguard Street. Foundry workers are gathering there, and they don't look too pleasant. This isn't the place for their picket lines, I dare say. Maybe an eyeful of constable uniforms will keep them in check."
"Sir," Javies said, saluting, "those masses are pushing up against the steps to the mansion. With respect, sir, don't you want us up there?"
"Governor's guards have jurisdiction, Lieutenant," the old captain said. "They brush us back if we try to do anything on the actual mansion grounds. Damn pewter-necked bulls. They barely give us warning any time the governor wants to have a say to the people, then expect us to do the hard work of policing this mess."
Javies saluted, and his team ran off.
"Sir," Marcy said, remaining behind, "Constable General Aradel wanted me to bring him a direct report on the speech. Do you think I could get a spot on those bleachers to watch?"
"No luck there," the captain said. "Every niece and nanny of a house lord has demanded a spot. They'll gut me if I send someone else over."
"Thank you anyway, sir. I'll see if I can work my way to the front of the crowd."
Marcy moved off.
"Wait, constable," the old man said. "Don't I know you?"
She looked back, blushing.
"I'm..."
"Lord Holmes's girl," the old captain said. "The bastard, that's it. Now, don't get red-faced. That's not meant as an insult, child. Just what you are, and that's it. Simple as day. I like your father. He was bad enough at cards to be fun to play against, but he was careful not to bet so much that I felt bad winning."
"Sir."
News of her nature, once kept discreet, had moved through all of high society. Hanging around Waxillium, who created such stirs, did have its drawbacks, and her mother did have something of a reason for her angry letters. Marcy was quite accepting of what she was. That didn't mean she liked having it thrown at her. Old nobleman officers like this, though, well, they came from a time when they felt they could say whatever they wanted, particularly about their subordinates.
"There's space with the reporters, little Harms," he said, pointing. "Up near the north side. Not great for watching, as you'll have steps in your way, but a great place for listening. Tell Constable Wells at the rope I said you could pass, and give my best to your father."
She saluted, still wrestling with a mixture of shame and indignation. He didn't mean anything by his comments, but rust and ruin. She had worked most of her life, swept under the rug with a few coins in her hand, her father refusing to openly acknowledge her. Among the constables, at least, couldn't she be known for her professional accomplishments, not the nature of her birth? Still, she wouldn't turn down the opportunity for a better spot, so she began to work her way around the square toward the section he'd specified. What was that? Wax thought. He spun to look away from the group of beggars he'd been questioning.
Wax!
Wayne called, turning away from another group of people.
What?
Wax ignored him, shoving through a crowd on the street toward the thing he'd seen. A face.
It can't be.
His frantic actions drew annoyed shouts from some people, but only dark glares from others. The days when a nobleman, even an allomancer, could quell with a look were passing. Wax eventually stumbled into a pocket of open ground and spun about.
Where?
Wild, every sense straining, he dropped a bullet casing and pushed, instantly popping up about 10 feet. Scanning, he whirled, the motion flaring his mistcoat tassels. The heavy flow of people on Tindwill Promenade continued toward the hub, near which the governor would apparently be making a speech.
That's a dangerous crowd,
a piece of him noticed. There were too many men wearing battered coats and bearing battered expressions. The labor issue was becoming a bigger and bigger problem. Half the city was underpaid and overworked. The other half was simply out of work. A strange dichotomy. He kept seeing men loitering on corners. Now they flowed together in streams. That would create dangerous rapids, as when a real river met rocks. Wax landed, heart thrumming like the drum of a march. He'd been sure of it this time. He had seen Bloody Tan in that crowd of men. A brief glimpse of a familiar face, the mortician killer, the last man Wax had hunted in the roughs before coming to Ellendale. The man who had caused Lessie's death.
Wax!
Wayne hurried up.
Wax, you all right? You look like you ate an egg you found in the gutter.
It's nothing, Wax said.
Aw,
Wayne said.
Then that look I saw. You were just contemplating your impending marriage to Steris, I guess.
Wax sighed, turning away from the crowds.
I imagined it. I must have imagined it.
I wish you'd leave Steris alone. She's not nearly so bad as you make her sound.
That's the same thing you said about that horse you bought. You remember? The one who only bit me?
Roseweather had good taste. Did you find anything? Wayne nodded, leading them out of the press of traffic.
Miss Steelrunner settled down nearby, all right, he said. She got a job doing bookkeeping for a jeweler down the road. She hasn't come in to work in over a week, though. The jeweler sent someone to her flat, but nobody answered the door.
You got the address? Wax asked.
Of course I did.
Wayne looked offended, shoving his hands into the pockets of his duster.
Got me a new pocket watch, too.
He held up one made of pure gold, with opaline workings on the face. Wax sighed. After a short trip back to the jeweler to return the watch, Wayne claimed he figured it had been for trade, since it had been sitting out on the counter with naught but a little box of glass around it. They made their way up the road to the Bornton district. This was a high-quality neighborhood, which also meant it had less character. No laundry airing in front of buildings, no people sitting on the steps. Instead, the street was lined by white townhouses and rows of apartment buildings with spiky iron decorations around their upper windows. They checked the address with one of the local newsboys and eventually found themselves in front of the apartment building in question.
"Someday I'd like to live in a fancy place like this," Wayne said wistfully.
"Wayne, you live in a mansion."
"It ain't fancy. It's opulent. Big difference."
"Which is?"
"Mostly it involves which kinds of glasses you drink out of, and what kind of art you hang."
Wayne looked offended.
"You need to know these things now, Wax, being filthy rich and all."
"Wayne, you're practically rich yourself, after the reward from the banisher's case." Wayne shrugged. He hadn't touched his share of that, which had been paid out mostly in aluminum recovered from Miles and his gang. Wax led the way up the steps running along the outside of the building. Idashwi's place was at the top, a small apartment on the rear with a view only of the back of other buildings. Wax slipped Vindication out of her holster, then knocked, standing to the side of the door in case someone shot through it. No response.
"Nice door," Wayne said softly. "Good wood."
He kicked it open. Wax leveled his gun and Wayne ducked inside, sliding up against the wall to avoid being backlit. He found a switch a moment later, turning on the room's electric lights. Wax raised the gun beside his head, pointing at the ceiling, and swept in. The apartment wasn't much to look at. The pile of folded blankets in the corner probably served as a bed. With steel sight, Wax saw no moving bits of metal. Everything was still and calm. Wax peeked into the bathroom while Wayne moved over to the only other room in the apartment, a kitchen. Indoor plumbing for the bathroom, electric lights. This was a fancy place. Most terrorists claim to prefer simple lives. What had led her to pay for something like this?
"Aw, hell," Wayne said from the kitchen. "That ain't no fun."
Wax moved over, gun out, and glanced around the corner into the kitchen. It was just large enough for one person to lie down in. He knew this because of the bloody corpse stretched out on the floor, her chest bearing a large hole in the center, her eyes staring sightlessly into the air.
"Looks like we're going to need a new prime suspect, Wax," Wayne said. "This one downright refuses to not be dead already."
Maris's position at the speech turned out to be exactly as advertised, nestled into a narrow gap in the crowd formed by the side steps of the mansion's forecourt. Around her, the members of the press clutched pencils and pads, ready to jot down bite-sized quotes from the governor's speech that might make good headlines. Maris was the only constable among them, and her lieutenant's bars didn't earn her much consideration from the reporters. Their view was obstructed not only by the position of the wide stone steps, but also by the governor's guard, a row of men and women in dark suits and hats, standing with hands clasped behind their backs along the steps. Only a pair of sketch artists, who stood at one corner of the knot of reporters, had anything resembling a good view of the governor's platform, which had been erected on the steps. That was fine with Maris. She didn't need to see much of Innate to digest and relate his words. Besides, this position gave her an excellent view of the gathering crowd, which she found more interesting. Dirty men stained with soot from work in the factories. Tired women who, because of the advent of electricity, could now be forced to work much longer hours well into the night, with a threat of dismissal to keep them at the loom. Yet there was hope in those eyes, hope that the governor would have encouragement to offer, a promised end to the city's growing strain.
"Mirabelle's rules," Maris thought, nodding to herself.
Mirabelle had been a statistician and psychologist in the 3rd century who had studied why some people worked harder than others. Turned out a man or woman was much more likely to do good work if they were invested, if they felt ownership of what they did and could see that it mattered. Her personal studies proved that crime went down when people had a sense of identity with and ownership of their community. That was the problem, because modern society was eroding those concepts. Life seemed more transient now, with people commonly relocating and changing jobs during their lifetime, things that had almost never happened a century ago. Progress had forced it upon them. These days, Ellendale just didn't need as many carriage drivers as it did automobile repairmen. You had to adapt, move, change. That was good, but it could also threaten identity, connection, and sense of purpose. The governor's guards studied the crowd with hostility, muttering about miscreants, as if seeing the crowd as barely contained malefactors who were looking for any excuse to riot and loot. To the contrary, these people wanted something stable, something that would let them sustain their communities or forge new ones. Rioting was rarely caused by greed, but frequently by frustration and hopelessness. The governor finally made his appearance, stepping from the mansion. Maris caught a few fragmentary glimpses of him between the legs of the guards. Innate was a tall, handsome man, unlike his brother, who had always seemed dumpy to Maris. Clean-shaven, with a wave in his salt-and-pepper hair and a trendy set of spectacles, Innate was the first governor to pose for his official portrait wearing spectacles. Would he know? Would he understand how to calm these people? He was corrupt, but it was a quiet kind of corruption. Little favors done to enrich himself or his friends. It was quite possible he did care for the people of his city, even while enriching himself. He stepped up to his platform, where a diminutive woman in a green dress skittered around, adjusting devices that looked like big cones, with their wide openings facing the crowd.
Marcy felt she should recognize the young woman, who was barely more than a girl, with long blonde hair and a lean face. Where had Marcy seen her before? She thought for a moment, then sidled up to one of the reporters to read over her shoulder.
Breezy day, blah, blah, air of violent suspense, whatever that means. There! Attended by the curious ministrations of Miss Sophie Tarxell, the inventor's daughter.
Sophie Tarxell. She'd been making an uproar, writing opinion pieces in the broadsheets about her father, who had supposedly been a great inventor, though Marcy had never heard or read his name before those articles.
"People of Ellendale,"
Governor Innate said, and Marcy was surprised by how his voice echoed across the square, loud and clear. Something to do with those devices, apparently.
"The papers would have you believe that this evening we stand on the brink of a crisis. But I assure you, no such problem exists. My brother was not the criminal they are condemning him to have been."
"Oh, Innate," Marcy thought, sighing to herself as she wrote. "That's not why they're here." Nobody had come to hear more about Windsting. What about the city's real problems?
"I will not suffer this defamation of my dear brother's character,"
Innate continued.
"He was a good man, a statesman and philanthropist. You might have forgotten the Hub Beautification Project that he spearheaded just 3 years ago, but I have not."
He continued in that vein. Marcy dutifully took notes for Captain Aradel, but she shook her head. Innate's goal was understandable. He hoped to preserve his family's reputation in the eyes of important investors and noblemen, and perhaps deflate some of the public anger. It wouldn't work. The people didn't actually care about Winsting. It was the deeper corruption, the feeling of powerlessness, that was destroying this city. As the speech progressed, laboring with explanations of how good a man Winsting had been, Marcy edged to the side in an attempt to get a better view. How was Innate responding to the crowd? He was charismatic. She could hear that even from the way he spoke. Maybe he was doing some good with his oratory alone, even if the speech lacked substance.
"A full investigation of the constables will be ordered,"
Innate continued.
"I am not convinced my brother was killed, as they say. My sources posit this might all be the result of a bungled raid, using my brother as willing bait to catch criminals. If that is true, and they put my brother in harm's way and are now covering it up, the responsible parties will answer for it."
Marcy moved to the side, but her view was obstructed by one of the guards who stepped in front of her. Annoyed, Marcy moved again, and again the guardsman moved. She'd have considered it deliberate if his back hadn't been to her.
"As for the floods in the east, we are sending relief. Your friends and relatives there shall be succored. We stand with them in the face of this disaster."
"Not good," she noted. "The people don't want to hear about aid going outside the city, no matter how necessary, not while things are going worse and worse here."
Marcy moved again. Aradel wanted her to judge the public's reaction, but she needed a better view. Her shuffling earned her a curse of annoyance from one of the reporters, and she finally got a sight of Innate on his podium. He moved into a longer rant against the press. Perhaps that was why the reporter had been so testy. She certainly would be. Marcy frowned. That guardsman who had been moving and shuffling and blocking her view had turned, and she could see a very odd expression on his face, like a grimace of pain. And he was whispering. At least his mouth was moving. Nobody else seemed to notice him, as they were focused on the speech. So Marcy was the first one to scream as the guardsman pulled a revolver from underneath his coat and leveled it at the governor. Wayne prowled around the dead woman's room. It was too clean. A room where people lived should have a healthy amount of clutter. Miss Steelrunner hadn't spent much time here. In the other room, Wax inspected the body. Wayne left him to that. He had no interest in poking at a corpse's insides, even if Wax claimed it was important. Wayne, instead, went looking for more interesting bits of life.
His first discovery was a small cache of bottles in a cabinet under the bathroom wash basin. Various forms of alcohol, the harder stuff, each a little gone. All save one, which was empty. Wayne gave it a sniff. Port. Not surprising, he thought. He took the whiskey and gave it a good swig.
Blech.
Too much bite, and far too warm. He took another swig as he spun about in the main room. These fancy neighborhoods were too quiet. People should be shouting outside. That was right for the city. He checked the trunk beside her sleeping pallet and found it contained three outfits, each clean and carefully folded. The terrace robes were on the bottom. Creases had set. These weren't worn often. The other two were modern designs, the one on top more daring than the one below. He took another swig of whiskey and wandered back into the room with the corpse. Wax had removed his hat and coat and knelt beside the body in his vest and slacks.
"You found the alcohol, I see," Wax said. "How uncharacteristic."
Wayne grinned, offering the bottle to Wax, who took a small swig.
"Ugh,"
he noted, handing it back.
"This murder is troubling, Wayne." "Oh, I'm sure she felt so." "Too many questions. Why did she leave the village, and why choose to live here? It doesn't feel very terrace."
"Oh, I can tell you why she was here," Wayne said.
"Well?"
"Think of yourself as a sheltered terrace woman in her 40s, Wayne said. "Old enough to have missed the chance to be a wild youth and starting to wish you'd done something more daring."
"The terrace don't long for wildness," Wax said, taking notes in a little book as he inspected the woman's wound. "They aren't daring. They're a reserved people."
"Ain't we, Terrace?"
"We're exceptions."
"Everyone's an exception to something, Wax. This girl, she left the village and found a whole world out here. She must have had an adventurous side."
"Whiskey." "She did," Wax admitted. "I didn't know her well, but she'd sneak out of the village as a youth. That was long ago."
"And she left again," Wayne said, "on account of the village being so dull as to bore the sense out of a scribe. Hell, even Steris would hate that place."
"Wayne."
"Our miss,"
Wayne said, waving the bottle toward the dead woman.
"She tried to remain conservative at first, so she got a job as a clerk, a good terrace occupation. She convinced herself that a nice apartment, where she was safe from the supposed horrors of lesser neighborhoods, was worth the expense. Simple stuff. But then some workers at the jeweler took her out and she let herself drink. She liked that. Awakened memories of sneaked drinks as a youth. She wanted more, so she bought a whole mess of different kinds of spirits to try them all out. She liked port best, by the way."
"Makes sense," Wax said.
"Now we find her with increasingly liberal dresses, showing more skin, spending more evenings out. Give her a few more months and she'd have turned into a right proper girl to have a good time with."
"Whiskey."
"She didn't get a few more months," Wax said softly.
He took something from his own pocket and handed it out to Wayne. A book, bound in leather, pocket-sized.
"Have a look through this."
Wayne took it, flipping through some pages.
"What is it?"
"The book that Death gave me."
Marcy's shout was lost in the roar as the governor ended his speech. Polite applause from the nobility, shouts and curses from most of the workers. The noise swallowed her shout like a single splash in a breaking tide. She fumbled for her handbag as the guard in the dark coat sighted with his gun at the governor. No, there wasn't time for her gun. She had to do something else. She jumped for the man and slowed time. She had metal in her this time. She'd made sure, after being embarrassed this morning. Her allomancy created a bubble of greatly slowed-down time, enveloping herself, the would-be assassin, and a few bystanders. She grabbed the man around the legs, but her speed bubble did the real work, trapping him inside, as everyone outside became a blur. The man squeezed his gun's trigger, and the crack of a gunshot rang amid the strange warping of sounds that she heard inside a bubble from those outside. One of his fellow guards, also caught in her bubble, shouted in alarm.
The fired bullet hit the perimeter of the speed bubble and was deflected. It shot out over the blur of the crowd, the governor's figure vanishing as, she assumed, he was rushed away. Maracy's lunge wasn't enough to topple the would-be assassin, and so she lay there, half on the steps, holding on to his legs and feeling foolish, until one of his companions hit him harder, knocking him down. She dropped the speed bubble and jumped back, the sudden roar of the crowd washing over her. The captured man struggled, shouting, as other guards piled onto him.
"So basically, with this hemallergy," Wax said, "you can make someone metalborn."
Wayne sniffled as he flipped through the book, and his cheeks were breaking out in some kind of rash. "Storing health," Wax thought. Wayne often ended up with rashes when he did that. They sat in the main room of Idashwi's apartment, away from the corpse, which they'd draped with a sheet. They'd paused briefly in their inspection to send the newsboy for the local constables. Wax ground his teeth. Idashwi's wound, it was just like those described in the book. Somebody had killed this woman with a spike through the chest, stealing her ferrochemical talent. The book described the process as tearing off a chunk of someone's soul. Using the spike, one could effectively attach that piece of soul to one's own, granting the powers of the deceased. In the old days, inquisitors had driven the spike right through the body of the one to be killed into the body of the person to gain the powers. That prevented any power from being lost. Apparently, coating the newly made spike in blood could achieve a similar effect.
He knew, Wax thought. Iron Eyes knew something like this was going to come.
The book had been written by the Lord Mistborn long ago to leave some record of the art known as hemallergy. Lesterborn's book said he considered it a crime that the words of Founding, Harmony's own record, omitted references to the dark art.
"So our killer knows this hemallergy stuff?" Wayne said.
"Yes," Wax said. "The killer used a spike to steal Idashwi's ferrochemical talent, then employed that ability to kill Lord Winsting and his guests. We have to assume that our killer could also have numerous other powers at their disposal. Any combination of allomantic or ferrochemical abilities. Or all of them."
Wayne whistled softly. "Did you discover anything else in your search of the room?" Wax asked.
"Not much."
"I understand the motive here," Wax said, glancing back toward the kitchen with the body. "But I don't yet have one for Winsting's murder. Or, well, I know of too many possibilities. I don't have the right motive."
"What did you find in the stiff's pockets?"
Wax hesitated.
"You didn't rifle through the pockets?"
Wayne asked, aghast.
"Wax, you're a terrible grave robber."
"I was distracted by the manner of death," Wax said, rising. "I'd have gotten to it."
The word distracted didn't really do justice to his emotions, to the profound shock, the numbness. For months, that book had only been an object of study. But now its contents had abruptly ceased being mere words on a page and had become a motive for murder.
"We're out of our depth," Wax thought, returning to the kitchen. "We've crept into the realm of the gods. Harmony, Iron Eyes, the Lord Mistborn."
Wayne pulled back the sheet, exposing that gaping hole in the woman's chest, right at the sternum. Who would know how to do something like this? Who would Harmony let know how to do something like this?
"Here,"
Wayne said, fishing in the woman's shirt pockets. He came out with a folded-up piece of paper. He unfolded it, then grunted.
"Huh. It's for you."
Wax's stomach plummeted. Wayne slowly turned the paper around. It was a sheet ripped from a ledger, filled with numbers and sums. Scrawled across it in a different hand was a single sentence, a familiar sentence. The very words Bloody Tan had said before jerking Lessie right into the path of Wax's bullet, making him kill the woman he loved. "Someone else moves us, lawman."
7.
"Look, Wax,"
Wayne said as the two of them entered Ladrian Mansion.
"I saw Tan's body. You shot him square in the head. That bloke was deader than a stuffed lion in a hunting lodge. It ain't him.
What if he was secretly metalborn? Wax asked. Miles could have survived a shot to the head.
Doesn't work that way, mate,
Wayne said, shutting the door and tossing his coat at Darian's. It hit the butler in the face.
If you're a bloodmaker, you've got a healer head wound right as it's happening. Once a bloke is actually dead, no power, allomantic or ferrochemical, is bringing him back.
I saw him, Wayne, twice. Once while chasing the marksman and then just earlier today.
Master, Darian said, folding Wayne's coat, new equipment has arrived for you from Miss Renette. She asked if you'd be willing to test it.
Oh, ruin, Wayne said. Oh, mister, what did she leave for me?
She said I was to slap you,
Darian admitted.
Oh, she does care. See that, Wax? She cares!
Wax nodded absently as Wayne tried to force Darian to slap him across the rear, which he doubted was what Renette had intended.
Sir,
Darian said, turning away from Wayne's proffered posterior,
in addition to the package, Lady Harms awaits you in the sitting room.
Wax hesitated, impatient to go upstairs. He needed time to think, preferably with his earring in, and to go through Renette's package. They were always very interesting. But he couldn't simply ignore Steris.
Thank you, Darians, Wax said. Send a note to my grandmother at the village that says we found the missing terrace woman, but someone had gotten to her and, regretfully, killed her before we arrived. Say the constables will explain the rest and may have questions for her.
Very well, my lord.
Wax pushed his way into the sitting room. Steris rose to greet him, and Wax kissed her hand.
I don't have a lot of time, Steris.
You've sunk your teeth in, then, she said, eyeing him up and down. I suppose this could be useful. If you catch the murderer of the governor's brother, it will be politically favorable.
Unless I drag some corpses out into the light.
Well, perhaps we can prepare for that, she said. Lady Zobel's party. You are still planning to attend with me?
Rusts. He'd forgotten all about it.
Our invitation has gone missing. I suspect Wayne is to blame, but it doesn't matter. You're lord of a great house. They won't turn us away.
Steris, I don't know if I have the time.
The governor is attending, Steris said. You could speak with him about his brother.
More meaningless conversation, Wax thought. More dances and political games. He needed to be working, hunting. Bloody Tan.
His eye twitched.
There was some talk of the governor not attending, Steris said, considering what happened today. However, I have it on the best authority that he will come. He doesn't want to appear to have anything to hide in these parlous times.
Wax frowned. Wait, what happened today?
Assassination attempt on the governor, Steris said. You really don't know?
I've been busy. Rusts. Someone tried to kill him? Who?
Some deranged man, Steris said. Not in his right mind. They caught him, I'm told.
I'll need to talk to the suspect, Wax said, walking for the door. It might be connected.
He wasn't a credible threat, Steris said. By all reports, the man's aim was terrible. He didn't come close to hitting his intended victim. Maxilium?
Wayne!
Wax said, shoving open the door.
We've got
on it already,
Wayne said, holding up a broadsheet from the table. Evening edition. Wax had a subscription. The top line read, Bold attack on the governor in daylight. Wayne tossed Wax's hat off the rack, then snapped his fingers toward the butler, who was in the process of hanging Wayne's duster in the coat closet. Darian sighed, getting it back out and carrying it over.
I'll try to make the party, Wax said to Steris, pulling his hat on. If I'm not back, feel free to go without me.
Steris folded her arms.
Oh, I suppose I should take the butler instead, then.
If you like.
Be careful about that, Steris, Wayne added. Wax's butlers have a tendency to explode.
Wax gave him a glare, and the two of them charged out the door toward the coach.
You still need private time for that thinking of yours?
Wayne asked.
Yes.
Never touch the stuff myself, Wayne said. Causes headaches. Hey, Oid!
Can I catch a ride up there with you?
The new coachman shrugged, making room for Wayne on top of the carriage. Wayne climbed up, and Wax stepped inside. This wouldn't be ideal, but it would have to do. He pulled down the window shades, then settled back as the coach began rolling. He took his earring out of his pocket, the earring of the Pathian religion. His was special. He'd been hand-delivered it under mysterious circumstances. Lately, though, he had avoided wearing it, as the book made clear what it must be. Long ago, a small spike of metal like this had allowed people to communicate with ruin and preservation, gods of the ancient world. It was hemallergy. Had this earring, then, been made by killing someone? Hesitantly, he slipped it in.
Unfortunately,
a voice said in his mind,
your fears about the earring are correct. It is a hemallergic spike.
Wax jumped, throwing open the carriage door with Allomancy, preparing his escape, while pulling out Vindication. Rusts, he'd heard that voice as if someone were sitting beside him.
Firing that gun would not have the effect you want, I think,
the voice said.
Even if you could see me, shooting at me would merely ruin the furnishings of your coach, costing precisely 84 boxings to repair when Miss Grimes takes it to the shop next week. You'd be left with a new wood panel on the coach body just behind me, which would never quite match those around it.
Wax breathed in and out.
Harmony?
Yes,
the voice said.
You're here, in my coach.
Technically, I am everywhere.
Wax trembled, mouth going dry. He forced himself to close the door and sit back down.
Tell me,
the voice said in his head.
What were you expecting to happen when you put in the earring, if not this?
Wax slid Vindication back into her holster.
I wasn't expecting an answer so promptly. And my reflexes tend to be on the jumpy side lately. Your deificness?
You may call me Harmony, or Lord, if you must.
The voice sounded amused.
Now, about what do you wish to speak?
You know.
Better to hear you say it.
Better for you to hear me say it, Wax said, or for me to hear myself say it?
Both.
Am I insane? Wax asked.
If you were, speaking to a figment of your delusion would certainly not diagnose that fact.
You're not helping much.
Then ask better questions, Waxillium.
Wax leaned forward.
He
clasped his hands before him.
You're real.
You've heard my voice. You've followed my path.
A few whispered words when I was in a moment of great stress, when I was gravely wounded, Wax said. Words I've doubted ever since. This is different. This is more real.
You need to hear it then, do you?
The voice said. It sounded as clear and ordinary as if someone normal, someone visible, sat there talking to him.
Very well. I am Harmony, the hero of ages, once called Sezed. At the end of one world, I took upon myself the powers of protection and destruction, and in so doing became the caretaker of the world to come. I am here, Waxillium, to tell you that you are not insane.
Bloody Tan lives.
Not exactly.
Wax frowned.
There are beings in this world who are neither human nor Kolos, something related to both. You call them the Faceless Immortals.
Chandra, Wax said. Like Tensun, the Guardian, or the person who gave me this earring.
They can take the corpses of the dead and use their bones to mimic a person who has died. They wear bodies like you wear clothing, changing back and forth as they wish. They were created by the Lord Ruler using hemallergy.
Your holy book gives few details about their organization, Wax said. But everyone knows that the Faceless Immortals are your servants.
not murderers.
Any being has choice,
Harmony said.
Even Kolos have the power to choose. This one, the being who wears Bloody Tan's body, has not made very good choices.
Who is he?
She is a member of the third generation, and you should know better than to assume everyone dangerous to be a male. Pa'alm was what we called her, but she has chosen the name Bleeder for herself. Waxillium, Bleeder is ancient, older than the destruction of the world, almost as old as the final empire. Indeed, she is even older than I am, though not older than my powers. She is crafty, careful, and brilliant, and I'm afraid that she might have gone mad.
The carriage turned a corner. One of your ancient servants, Wax said, has gone mad and is killing people.
Yes.
So stop her.
It is not so simple.
Free will? Wax said, annoyed.
No, not in this case. I can directly control a being who has pierced herself with too much hemallergy. In this case, I would act, for Bleeder has disobeyed her contract with me and opened herself up for my intervention. Something is wrong, unfortunately.
What? Wax asked. God was silent for a time.
I don't know yet.
Wax felt cold. Is that possible?
It appears so. Somehow, Bleeder has figured out how to hide from me. At times I can spot her, but only when she takes direct and obvious action. Unfortunately, she has removed one of her blessings, one of the two spikes that Kundra must keep inside themselves to retain their cognition. I would forcibly control her if I could, but one spike does not pierce the soul sufficiently for me to get in.
Cognition, Wax said. Two spikes are required for the Kundra to be able to think. But she is going around with only one. Which means...
insanity,
Harmony said, his voice softer in Wax's ear.
But something is wrong beyond that. She can hide from me, and while I can speak to her, she doesn't have to listen, and I can't keep track of where she is.
Didn't you say you were everywhere?
My essence is, Harmony said. But this thing that I am, it is more complex than you might expect.
Being God is more complex than a mortal can comprehend, Wax said. What a surprise. Harmony chuckled softly.
Wait, Wax thought.
Did I just get sarcastic with God himself?
Yes, you did,
Harmony said.
It is well. Few act that way toward me, even among the Kundra. It feels good to me, like older times. Since Kelsier... well, I haven't had much of that.
You can hear my thoughts? Wax asked.
When you have the earring in, yes. I gain the ability to hear your preservation, and the ability to speak to you from ruin. Each had only one half. I always found it puzzling. Regardless, I know you have been reading young Lesterborn's book. I am not pleased that he made it, but I could not forbid you. I will trust that Marsh was wise in giving it to you. Bleeder can use hemallergy, but in a way she should not be able to. Kundra do not have allomantic or ferrochemical powers. She has learned to take these, and to use them to maintain her Kundra form. Fortunately, she is limited. She can only use one spike at a time. Otherwise, she will open herself to my control. If she trades spikes, she must do it by ripping out her single one, and then falling onto another, digesting it, and returning her to sapience. I do not know her game within this city, but I'm alarmed by it. She has spent centuries studying human behavior. She is planning something.
I'll have to stop her then.
I will send you help.
I assume, considering the source, it will be spectacular. Harmony sighed softly. In Wax's mind's eye, he had a sudden image of a being standing with hands clasped behind him, eternity extended into darkness before him. Tall, robed, back to Wax, almost visible and distinct, yet somehow completely unknowable at the same time.
Waxillium, Harmony said. I have tried to explain this to you, but I did not do a good job, I think. My hands are tied, and I am bounded.
Who ties God's hands?
I tied them myself.
Wax frowned.
I hold both ruin and preservation, Harmony said. The danger in carrying these opposed powers is that I can see both sides. The need for life, the need for death. I am balance, and to an extent, I am neutrality.
But Bleeder used to be one of your own, and now she's acting against you.
She used to be of preservation. She has moved to being of ruin. Both are needed.
Murderers are needed, Wax said flatly.
Yes. No. The potential for murderers is needed. Waxillium, I, the personality you speak to, agree with your indignation. But the powers that I am, the essence of myself, cannot allow me to take sides. Already I fear that I have made things too easy for men. This city, the perfect climate, the ground that renews, you were to have had the radio a century ago, but you didn't need it. So you didn't strive for it. You ignore aviation and cannot tame the wilds because you don't care to study proper irrigation or fertilization.
The radio? What is that?
You don't explore,
Harmony continued, ignoring Wax's confusion.
Why would you? You have everything you want here. You've barely progressed technologically from what I gave you in the books. Yet others, who were nearly destroyed. I made a mistake with you, I now see. I still make many. Does that ruin your faith, Waxillium? Does it worry you that your God is fallible?
You never claimed to be fallible, so far as I remember.
No, I did not.
Wax felt a warmth, a fire, as if the inside of the carriage were heating to incredible temperatures.
I loathe suffering, Waxillium. I hate that people like Bleeder must be allowed to do what they do. I cannot stop them. You can. I beg you to do so.
I will try.
Good. Oh, and Waxillium.
Yes, Lord?
Do be less harsh with Marisi Colmes. You aren't my only agent in the affairs of men. I worked quite hard to maneuver Marisi into a position where she could do good in this city. It is taxing to have you continue to dismiss her because her admiration makes you uncomfortable.
Wax swallowed. Yes, Lord.
I will send you help.
The voice vanished. The temperature returned to normal. Wax leaned back, sweating, feeling drained. A rapping came at his window. Hesitant, Wax pulled aside the shade. Wax's face hung there, upside down, his hand holding his hat onto his head.
"You done talking to yourself, Wax?" he asked.
Yes, I am.
I heard voices in my head once too, you know.
You did?
Sure. Gave me a fright. I banged my head against the wall until I went unconscious. Never heard them again. Ha! Showed 'em good I did. If rats move in, best thing to do is burn the nest and send 'em packing.
And the nest was your head?
Yep.
The sad thing was, Wayne probably wasn't lying. Being unkillable, so long as one had some healing power stored up, could do strange things to a person's sense of self-preservation. Of course, Wayne had probably been drunk at the time. That also tended to do strange things to a person's sense of preservation.
"Well, anyway," Wayne said, "we're almost to the precinct headquarters. Time to go back to being dirty Connors. At least they'll probably have scones inside."
Maracy stood in the precinct station with arms folded, partially to hide the fact that her hands were still trembling. That was unfair. She'd been in firefights numerous times now. She should be accustomed to this. But still, after the jolt of it all wore off, the moment of thrill and action, she occasionally found herself feeling drained. Surely she'd get past it eventually.
"He was wearing these, sir,"
Reddy said, placing a pair of bracers onto the table with a thump.
"No other metal on his body save for the gun and a pocket full of rounds. We've called in the First Octant Precinct's leecher to make sure he doesn't have any metal swallowed, but we can't be certain until she arrives."
Auradel picked up one of the bracers, turning it over in his hands. The dim room was a kind of balcony, overlooking the interrogation chamber below, where the assassin Maracy had stopped, sat slumped in a chair. His name was Ryan. No house, though they'd located his family. He was tied with ropes to a large stone behind his chair. No metal in the room, to make it safe to stow coin shots or lurchers. Stone floor, walls made of thick wood joined with wooden pegs. Almost primitive in feel. The balcony had glass walls, letting them look down upon him without being heard.
"So he's metal-born,"
said Lieutenant Cabarel, the only other person in the room. The stout woman picked up the other bracer.
"Why didn't he use his abilities in the assassination? If he killed Winsting with ferrochemical speed, like old Waxillium Dawnshot says, he should have done the same today."
"Maybe he didn't kill Winsting," Auradel said. "The attacks could be unrelated."
"He fits the profile, though, sir," Reddy said. "Winsting's bodyguards probably would have trusted a member of the governor's personal guard. He could have talked his way past them and done the deed."
"Hard to imagine Winsting's guards letting even someone like that in alone with their charge, Captain,"
Auradel said.
"After a firefight where others were being killed, they'd be tense, suspicious."
Down below, the suspect began rocking back and forth on his seat. The vents that would allow them to listen in on him were closed, but she had a sense that he was muttering to himself again.
"So we just ask him,"
Cabarel said.
"Again?" Reddy said. "You heard before, all he does is mumble."
"Then encourage him," Cabarel said. "You're pretty good at that, Reddy."
"I suppose his face could use a few new bruises," Reddy said. "You know you can't do that,"
Maracy said from beside the window. Reddy looked at her.
"Don't quote statistics at me, Combs. I've found I can make a man speak the truth no matter what you claim."
"It isn't statistics this time," Maracy said. "If you actively torture that man, you'll ruin him for prosecution. His attorneys will get him off for sure."
Reddy gave her a scowl.
"So send for his daughter,"
Cabarel said, glancing over the fact sheet they had on the man.
"We threaten her in front of him, but don't do anything to harm her. He'll talk."
Maracy rubbed her forehead.
"That's specifically illegal, Cabarel. Do you people know nothing about Article 89? He has rights."
"He's a criminal," Reddy said.
"He's a suspected criminal,"
Maracy sighed.
"You can't continue to act as you have in the past, Reddy. New laws are in place. They're only going to get stricter, and the defense attorneys are increasingly clever."
"The solicitors have sold out to the other side," Cabarel said with a nod. "She's right."
Maracy remained silent on that score. Of course, it wasn't really a matter of selling out at all. But she'd settle for the constable's learning to follow the rules, regardless of the reasoning.
"I think," Reddy said, "that it's unfortunate we've got someone among us who seems to be more on the solicitor's side than on the side of justice. She knows more about their ways than ours."
"Perhaps she does,"
Auradel said in a soft, stern voice.
"And one might consider that to be exactly why I brought her in among us, Captain Reddy. Combs knows contemporary legal codes.
If you paid more attention to the very laws you are sworn to uphold, perhaps Daphnin wouldn't have gotten back on the street last month.
Reddy blushed, bowing his head. Aradel stepped up beside Marcy, looking down at the captive.
How are you at interrogating hostile witnesses, Lieutenant?
Less practiced than I'd like to be, she replied with a grimace. I'm willing to give it a try, but we might as well wait for a few more minutes.
Why?
Distantly, a door slammed.
That's why, Marcy said.
A moment later, the door into their observation chamber was flung open, pushed by Waxillium as he approached. Couldn't the man be bothered to lift a hand from time to time? He strode in, tailed by Wayne, who was for some reason wearing Constable Terry's hat. Waxillium looked down at the captive. He narrowed his eyes, then glanced at the bracers on the table nearby. One jumped, then fell off the table, pushed by his unseen allomantic ability. He grunted.
Those aren't metal mines, he said. This man is a decoy. You've been duped.
He turned as if to leave. Wayne slouched down in one of the chairs and put his feet up beside the bracers, then promptly started snoring.
Wait. That's it?
Reddy said, glancing at Waxillium.
You aren't even going to interrogate him?
I'll talk to him, Waxillium said. He might give us clues that will help find Winsting's killer, but it wasn't that man.
How can you be so sure, Waxillium? Marcy said.
It takes more effort to push on real metal mines, Waxillium said, pointing. And that man is too obvious. Whoever did this has predicted our conjecture that one of Innate's guards was behind the murder and wants us to jump on this man as a suspect. They want us to assume we have the killer in custody. Why, though? Are they planning something tonight?
Distracted, he walked toward the door.
I'm going to talk to the prisoner. Marcy, I wouldn't mind another set of ears.
She started. He was asking for her help? That was a change from making her feel guilty every time she showed up at a crime scene. She glanced at Aradel, who gave her leave, and she hurried after Waxillium. In the stairwell down, Waxillium stopped and turned toward her. He was wearing his rough's hat. He only did that when he was in full-on tough lawman mode.
I hear you brought this guy in.
I did.
Nice work.
That should not have given her the thrill that it did. She didn't need his approval. It was nice, nonetheless. He continued to study her, as if on the verge of saying something more.
What?
Marcy asked.
I spoke to God on the way over here.
All right, Marcy said. I'm glad you're devout enough to say a prayer now and then.
Yes. Thing is,
he spoke back. She cocked her head, trying to judge the meaning of that. But Waxillium Ladrian was nothing if not earnest. Rusts, often he was too blunt.
All right, she said. What did he tell you?
Our killer is a faceless immortal, Waxillium said, starting down the steps again. A creature who calls herself Bleeder. She can change shapes by taking the bones of the dead, and she's been driven mad. Even Harmony doesn't know her purposes.
Marcy followed him down, trying to swallow that. Mistwraiths and Chondra. Those were things out of the Historica, not real life. Then again, once she would have said that men like Miles Hundredlives and Waxillium Dawnshot were men out of stories. They'd lived up to the legends to a surprising degree.
So that could be her,
Marcy said, gesturing toward the wall separating them from the prisoner.
She could have any shape, any face. Why are you so sure this isn't the killer?
Because the governor is still alive, Waxillium said softly. The creature who's behind this casually murdered Winsting in a safe room, behind a wall of guards after intentionally starting a firefight in the room above. She wouldn't be caught like this. It's a taunt.
He looked to Marcy. But I can't be certain. Not 100%. So I need you to know what we're up against. She nodded to him, and he nodded back. Then he led the way out of the stairwell and around the corner toward the interrogation room. Marcy took a bit of satisfaction in the fact that the corporal there looked to her for authorization before opening the door for Waxillium. The poor captive inside sat with his arms tied tight, staring at the table in front of him. He muttered softly. Waxillium walked straight up to the table and took the other seat, settling down and putting his hat on the table. Maracy lingered back, where, in case they were wrong about the prisoner, she'd be out of reach but able to offer aid. Waxillium tapped the table with his index finger as if trying to decide what to say. The prisoner, Ryan, finally looked up.
"She said you'd come talk to me," Ryan said softly.
"She," Waxillium said.
"God."
"Harmony?"
"No. She said I had to kill the governor. Had to attack him. I tried not to listen."
Waxillium narrowed his eyes. "You met her. What did she look like? What face was she wearing?"
"You can't save him," Ryan whispered. "She's going to kill him. She promised me freedom, but here I am bound. Oh, ruin."
He took a deep breath.
"There's something for you. In my arm.
In your—" Waxillium actually seemed disturbed. Maracy took an unconscious step forward, noticing for the first time a small bulge in the prisoner's forearm. Before she could quote the legal problems with doing so, Waxillium stood up and took that arm, making a quick slice in the skin. He pulled something out, bloody. "A coin?" Maracy stepped forward again as the prisoner reached to his head with his bleeding arm and started humming to himself. Waxillium wiped off the coin with his handkerchief. He inspected it, then turned it over. Then he grew very still, paling. He stood up suddenly.
"Where did you get this?"
he demanded. Ryan only continued humming.
"Where?"
Waxillium demanded, grabbing the man by the front of the shirt.
"Waxillium,"
Maracy said, running up, hand on his arm.
"Stop!"
He looked to her, then dropped Ryan.
"What is that coin?"
Maracy asked. "A message," Waxillium said, shoving the coin in his pocket. "This man won't know anything of use. Bleeder knew we might capture him." "Do you have plans for tonight?" She frowned.
"What? Why are you asking?"
"Governor's attending a party. Sarah says he won't cancel despite what has happened, and this is the sort of thing she's always right about. He'll want to put up a strong front, and won't want his political enemies to think he has anything to either hide or fear. We need to be at that party, because I guarantee Bleeder will be." 8. Young Waxillium, age 12, looked from one coin to the other. Both bore a picture of the Lord Mistborn on the front, standing with his left arm outspread toward the Ellendale Basin. On the back, each displayed a picture of the First Central Bank, in which his family owned a large stake.
"Well?"
Edworn asked. He had a stern face and perfect hair. He wore his suit like he'd been born in it, and to him it was a uniform of war. The youthful Waxillium looked from one to the other.
"It is understandable you can't spot the difference," Edworn said. "It takes an expert, which is why so few of these have been discovered. More may actually be in circulation. We can't know how many. One of those is an ordinary coin. The other has a very special defect."
The carriage continued rattling through the streets as Waxillium studied the coins. Then he unfocused his eyes. It was a trick he'd been taught by a friend at a party recently, used for making two drawings spring to life by overlapping them. Eyes unfocused, coins before him, he crossed his eyes intentionally and let the images of the two coins overlap one another. When they locked into place, the element of the picture that wasn't the same, one of the pillars on the bank building, fuzzed as his eyes were unable to focus on that point.
"The mistake happened," Uncle Edworn continued, "because a defective coin striker was used. One worker at the mint brought home a pocketful of these curiosities, which were never supposed to enter circulation. You won't be able to see it, but the error—"
"It's the pillars," Waxillium said, "on the right side of the bank picture. They are spaced too closely."
"Yes. How did you know that? Who told you?"
"I saw it,"
Waxillium said, handing the coins back.
"Nonsense," Uncle Edwin said. "Your lie is not a believable one, but I can respect your attempt at hiding your source."
He held up one of the coins.
"This is the most valuable defective coin in Ellendale history. It's worth as much as a small house. Studying it taught me something important."
"That rich people are foolish? They'll pay more money for a coin than it's worth?"
"All people are foolish, just in different ways," Uncle Edwin said offhandedly. "That lesson I learned elsewhere. No, this coin showed me a harsh but invaluable truth. Money is meaningless."
Waxillium perked up. "What?"
"Only expectation has value as currency, Waxillium," Uncle Edwin said. "This coin is worth more than the others because people think it is. They expect it to be. The most important things in the world are worth only what people will pay for them. If you can raise someone's expectation, if you can make them need something, that is the source of wealth. Owning things of value is secondary to creating things of value where none once existed."
The carriage stopped. Outside, an intimidating flight of stone steps led up to the very bank pictured on the coin. Uncle Edwin waited for the coachman to open his door, but Waxillium hopped down on his own. Uncle Edwin met him on the steps.
"Your father," Uncle said, "is hopeless with economics. I have worked on him for years, but he cannot, or will not, learn. I have great expectations of you, Waxillium. Banking is not your only option for serving your house. However, after today, I suspect you will recognize it as the best one."
"I'm not going to be a banker," Waxillium said, climbing the steps.
"Oh, you have your eye on administering the Teamsters after all?"
"No," Waxillium said. "I'm going to be a hero." His uncle chose not to reply immediately as they approached the top of the steps. Finally, he said softly,
"You are 12 years old, and you still speak of this. I expect such foolishness from your sister, but your father should have beaten it out of you by now."
Waxillium turned defiant eyes up at his uncle.
"The day of heroes has passed," Uncle Edwin said. "The stories of people breaking out of history belong to another world. We have reached an era of modernism, both louder and more silent at the same time. You watch. Where once kings and warriors shaped the world, now quiet men in offices will do the same, and do it far, far more effectively."
They entered the bank lobby, which had a low ceiling and a wall of cage-like bars with hunched-over people inside who received or dispersed cash from or to those who waited in lines. Waxillium's uncle led him around to the back. The dark wood furnishings and mold-colored rug made it feel like dusk in the room, even with windows open and gas lamps burning.
"There are 2 appointments today I wanted you to observe," Uncle Edwin said as they entered a long, unadorned room.
The chairs faced the wall. This was a viewing room, a place to spy upon meetings in the bank. His uncle gestured for him to sit, then pulled aside a panel in the wall, revealing a glass slit that let them see the 2 people in the next room. One was a male banker in a vest and slacks. He sat at an imposing desk, speaking with a middle-aged man in dusty clothing, holding a felt cap in his fingers.
"The loan will help us move up," the dirty man said. "Get a place out of the slums. I have 3 sons. We'll work hard. I promise you we will."
The banker looked down his nose at the man, then riffled through papers. Uncle Edwin closed the slit, surprising Waxillium with the abrupt motion. His uncle rose and Waxillium followed, moving to another set of chairs along the same wall. A 2nd spy slit let them look in on another room similar to the first. A female banker in vest and skirt sat behind a similarly intimidating desk. The patron, however, was tall, clean, and relaxed.
"Are you certain you need another boat, Lord Nicolin?"
the banker asked.
Of course I'm certain. Would I bother coming here if I weren't serious? Honestly, you people should allow my steward to make these arrangements. That's what stewards are for, after all.
Uncle Edwin closed the slit with a quiet snap, then turned to Waxillium.
You are watching a revolution.
A revolution? Waxillium asked. He'd studied banking. Well, he'd been forced to study it by his tutors. This sounds like what happens every day at a bank.
Ah, Uncle Edwin said. You know all this already. And to which of these men will we give a loan?
The rich one, Waxillium said, assuming he's not lying or acting somehow.
No, Nicolin is legitimately wealthy, Uncle Edwin said. He has banked with us numerous times in the past, and he never misses his payments.
So you'll loan money to him and not the other?
Wrong, Uncle Edwin said. We'll lend to both.
You'll use the good credit of the rich man to underwrite the risk of helping the poor man? Uncle Edwin seemed surprised.
Your tutors have been diligent.
Waxillium shrugged, but inwardly he found himself growing interested. Perhaps this was a way to become a hero. Maybe Uncle Edwin was right and the frontier was shrinking, the need for men of action vanishing. Maybe this new world wasn't at all like the one that the ascendant warrior and the survivor had lived in. Waxillium could carefully balance risks and give money to those who needed it. If men in suits would someday run the world, couldn't they also make it a better place?
Your assessment is correct on one hand, Uncle Edwin said, oblivious to the direction Waxillium had been thinking. But flawed on the other. Yes, we will lend to the poor man, but we will not accept risk to do so.
But
the papers our banker is now presenting will tie the laborer in debt that is impossible to escape. If he fails to meet payments, his signature on that paper will allow us to go directly to his employer and take a percentage of his wages. If that isn't enough, we can do the same for his sons. The rich man has banked with us many times, and his house negotiated favorable terms. We will earn barely 3% on what we lend him. But the laborer is desperate, and no other bank will consider him. He'll pay us 12%.
Uncle Edwin leaned in.
The other banks don't see it yet. They lend safely and safely only. They have not changed as the world has. Workers earn more now than they ever did, and they're hungry to pay for things once outside their reach. In the last 6 months, we have pushed aggressively to lend to the common people of the city. They flock to us, and will soon make us very, very wealthy.
You'll make slaves of them,
Waxillium said, horrified. His uncle took out the error coin and set it on the counter beside Waxillium.
This coin is a mistake, an embarrassment. Now it is worth more than thousands of its companions combined. Value created where none once existed. I will take the poor of this city and make of them the same thing. As I said, a revolution.
Waxillium felt sick.
The coin is for you, Uncle Edwin said, standing. I wish it to be a reminder. The gift that will...
Waxillium snatched the coin off the counter, then bolted out the door.
Waxillium!
His uncle called. The bank was a labyrinth, but Waxillium found his way. He burst into the small room where the poor man sat in consultation with the loan officer. The laborer looked up from the stack of papers. He'd be barely literate. He wouldn't even know what he was signing. Waxillium set the coin down on the desk before him.
This is a misprinted coin, something that collectors covet. Take it. Sell it at a curiosity shop. Don't take less than 2,000 for it. And use the money to move your family out of the slum. Don't sign those documents. They'll be like a chain around your neck.
Wax paused in his story. He held the coin in front of him, studying it as he and Steris rode toward the party.
Well?
Steris asked, sitting across from him in the carriage.
What did your uncle do?
He was livid, of course, Wax said. The laborer signed the papers. He couldn't believe that I'd actually give him something so valuable. My uncle came in, wove lies in the air like pretty puffs of colored smoke, and got his documents.